This is an interview for the Purdue University Archives recorded on August 29, 1972. An interview between Emeritus Frederick L. Huffey and Professor R.B. Eccles, Department of History. Well, let's start out this morning, President Huffey, let me ask you about problems that you encountered in administering university finance.
Well, the university itself is a, what might be called a, what is actually a state corporation. The trustees are empowered under the Legislative Act founding the university to manage the institution. And in the Basic Act, the power to manage is almost complete. In its operations then, the Board of Trustees, representing the people of the state, act as a board of directors, similar to the governing boards of private corporations. As it stands today, Purdue University is a very large and complex institution. And its working relationships in education, research, and public service extend across almost the entire spectrum of national activity, national, state, and local activities. And the institutions of our society, our total society. The University Corporation has thousands of employees. It has the main central campus in Lafayette, West Lafayette. It has four regional campuses. It has dozens of research farms related to the program, directly related and operated under the aegis of the School of Agriculture. It's the university's sources of income are many and varied. Primary source supporting its teaching missions is, of course, from the legislature of the state of Indiana in the form of biennial appropriations for operating, so-called operating budget. Another source of income is, of course, the tuition and fees charged to its students. Another source of income, of course, is from federal grants for the support of special programs such as School of Agriculture, the Cooperative Extension Service, which is an educational program with statewide ramifications and operations, the Agricultural Extension Research Service, Agricultural Experiment Station, or research arm of agriculture, is supported by special appropriations, both federal and state, allocated and appropriated for the specific purpose of promoting and supporting agricultural research. Federal funds in the form of research grants and contracts. Federal funds for building programs, going way back to the decade of the 30s and the Depression years with the WPA program. Followed by, of course, the post-war special federal support programs, which provided capital funds for not only buildings, but also scientific equipment, library grants, so on. Another source of income, of course, is from industrial grants for the support of graduate programs, research fellowships, and research programs. Further source of funds, of course, are those derived from gifts to the university, which accumulate and are held in trust and managed by the university over many years, the income of which is used to supplement the other sources. The university itself provides services to students. The largest single operational service to students is, of course, the dormitory residential hall system. At the present time, provision equipped buildings are have been built and staffed and are operated by the university to house students, something like 12,000 of them. In effect, this becomes a tremendous business management problem, staffing and feeding and housing 12,000 students. But doing more than this, the problem is to provide in the residence halls a living environment, comfortable, safe, reasonable in price, together with counseling services, recreational services, which make life in the university residence halls conducive to effective learning, insofar as this can be done. As everyone recognizes that learning on the part of an individual is not limited to the classroom. It occurs throughout the individual's waking hours. And a large part of each individual's own personal development is stimulated, aided, helped. And of course, interfered with by the elements of his environment, the people with whom he must perforce associate as a member of the student body. But in any event, the corporate university is a very, very large, complex financial entity where the highest form of financial management and skill is required to keep track of and to be held accountable for every dollar that comes into the university system. I have never differentiated with respect to accountability for dollars and how they're used between the source of the dollar, whether it be federal, local, state, private, student. Each dollar should be spent efficiently. Each dollar should be accounted for. And each dollar should be, the attempt should be made to achieve maximum productivity for each dollar spent. Purdue has had distinguished financial leadership, not only during my administration, but also during that of my predecessor, Dr. Edward C. Elliott. And when I took over in 1946, after Elliott's retirement, he bequeathed to me a comparatively small state university, but an exceedingly well-managed one. In turn, when I retired, I turned over to my successor an exceedingly well-managed university, which had never in its history been in serious financial difficulty. This long record of distinguished financial management is due in the main to two great treasurers, chief business officers at Purdue University, Mr. R.B. Stewart, who served as chief business officer under Elliott for 22 or 3 years, and then with me until his retirement. And when he was officially retired, he was succeeded by Mr. Lytle J. Freehafer.
Could you get into the way in which a budget is constructed?
The construction of the annual university budget is a long and involved process which begins early in each academic year with, during the later years of my regime, with what we called academic reviews, where the senior staff of the president, meeting with the deans and department heads and all the divisions of the university, reviewed the entire programs of each school and department of the university. Generally in January, general instructions go to the deans of the division, deans and directors of all the divisions of the university, with respect to general instructions for the making of their budgets, these instructions being based on our best estimates of what funds are likely to be available. The budgetary process in the schools and divisions of the university, of course, is a function of the deans, operating under general guidelines with respect to such general matters as the amount of money available for salary increases and how those increases are to be determined within the departments and schools of the university. On this particular point, which is of course of vital interest to all the faculty members of the university, Purdue has operated on the basis of merit increases. We have never had a general blanket across the board salary increase for everybody of the same general amount, except on the one occasion when we changed the retirement system from a 10% annual contribution to 15%, and the university took over the entire payment of the retirement system. This meant an automatic 5% increase for everybody under the faculty retirement system that particular year. One can debate the wisdom of such a policy, but I felt that superior performance, comma, as measured, as best you can measure it by those responsible for the functions of the university, teaching and research and public service, should be rewarded, and that it wasn't the average salary that interested the faculty member, it was his own personal salary. And the top ranking salaries were the salaries the best men commanded, could command. And in the years, in my years at Purdue, we saw the salary structures for the state universities increase to a point where one of the Harvard deans was complaining about the salaries paid by state universities to some of the individuals who grace the faculties of our leading state universities. And when Harvard, which has led the league for several centuries, complains, you have one of the best measures of progress on the part of the other institutions. Another element of budget policy which I've always been interested in is the budget for the physical plant, the maintenance of what we have, our buildings, our equipment, our campus, our in total structural environment of the university. And in many respects, Purdue University is one of the cleanest, most efficient university campuses in the nation. The best illustration I can think of is the Purdue Memorial Union, an extremely busy center involving thousands and thousands of people, services to them of many kinds, functions of many kinds. And in all the years my term at Purdue, no one has ever walked in that building and found it dirty or littered, except for the period of 2 or 3 weeks when it was occupied by the sit-in groups. We set high standards in the specifications for our buildings. And historically, Purdue has been a red brick university. And the problem for the university architect, as architectural styles changed through the past 50 years, has been to use the red brick, but to modernize it. In some of our newest buildings, while basically of red brick construction, have an architectural quality and a cleanliness of design, a simplicity of design, which is, I think, quite aesthetically attractive and has given us a architecturally unified campus, with few exceptions.
Notable would be the new business offices, an efficient and attractive building.
Utilizing modern concepts of design and providing quarters for a staff of that particular kind, a business staff, service staff. Well, it's nice to be able to have the money to provide external architectural beauty. A university, of course, any university, the important thing is what's in the buildings. It's like a library. Well, it's nice to have a beautiful library. What's important is what's stored in the library and the kind of services that the library is able to provide to the users, namely the faculty and students and others outside in the working professional world. In general, our laboratories and our many, many libraries in the university are well equipped and provide services in a scientific and technological institution which meet the needs of the missions of the teaching missions and research missions of the university. The academic capital structures of the university have been built in the main with state capital appropriations and supplemented with federal appropriations. The service buildings of the university, residence halls, unions, athletic facilities, non-academic buildings of all kinds, have been built in the main using debt financing techniques. Since most of these buildings are in the category of self-supporting enterprises. The university borrows money, builds a residence hall, pays off the bonds from the income from the residence halls. Likewise with the athletic facilities, the university borrows the money, builds the facilities, and the income from football pays it off in time until the debt is paid. If and when the debt is paid off, then the buildings belong to the university. In the middle 50s, late 50s, the need for academic structures was increased academic facilities, classrooms, offices, lecture rooms, laboratories, was so great that we persuaded the legislature to authorize debt financing for academic buildings. This is accomplished by taking a part of the charge to students, tuition charges, seconding it and reserving it to support bond issues for academic buildings. And in effect, what this does is call for 25 to 30 generations of students who use the building to pay for those buildings by virtue of the fees they pay the university. The academic buildings in our regional campus development, until as late as 1965, were debt financed by the university through subsidiary corporations, which borrowed the money, built the buildings, and then rented them to the university, and the university secured the rental payments, which retired the bonds, by seconding and reserving a portion of the charges made to students who took work at the regional campus. It's interesting to note that in the history of the development of the Purdue Memorial Union, which first portion of that building was built along about 1923 or 24 with a gift, with gifts from the Alumni Association and a bond issue. And over the years, it's been expanded five successive times, each time with another bond issue, which is then paid off by the union, by the reservation of the student union fee, which all students pay to pay off the debts of the Purdue Student Union. As a state corporation, the Board of Trustees has long had a basic policy that with respect to the management of the university's money, since it belonged to the people of the state of Indiana, that the trustees would generally follow all regulations imposed by the state vis-a-vis the spending of money, state money, in the other arms of state government. In other words, the trustees adopted policies which put limitations on how the corporation, the university's corporation, could spend state appropriations. Now, it's important in the management of the university, financial management of the university, that monies be made available for a whole variety of expenditures which the state, by policy, would not support. Accordingly, the technique of the university-related foundations was developed to a high degree of efficiency and the support of the university. The first of these foundations was the Ross Aid Foundation, which was created at the time Purdue's first football stadium was built. The Ross Aid Foundation raised money, borrowed money, and built the first stadium and rented it to the university. Today, Purdue Purdue Stadium, seating 70,000 people, still is owned by the Rossade Foundation and is rented to the university for $1 per year. The rent is $1 per year because the stadium, as it stands now, is completely paid for. The second of these foundations serving the university was the Purdue Research Foundation, which was established in 1928 or 29 by President Eliot, working with Dave Ross, great late great benefactor and trustee of Purdue, R.B. Stewart, J.K. Lilly, the father of J.K. Lilly, the son of the founder of Eli Lilly and Company. The Purdue Research Foundation was established as a related foundation to be a corporation to receive gifts and monies to help develop the graduate school and research program of Purdue. University the beginning of the decade of the 30s. Purdue Research Foundation started with an original capital contribution of about $50,000. I think $25,000 from Dave Ross and $25,000 from J.K. Lilly. It was used as a private corporation, private foundation, as a vehicle, as an administrative vehicle to serve the university. Its assets, it was used as a recipient for trust funds, to manage such trust funds, the income of which is used for scholarship programs, fellowship programs, research programs, travel grant programs for faculty, summer grant programs, equipment programs, book programs, a whole host of programs which were worthy of support and were of value to the university staff. Over the years, the resources of the Purdue Research Foundation grew from an original $50,000 to something now today valued between $25 and $30 million. Purdue Research Foundation was also used as the university vehicle for federal and industrial research contracting. Federal government, agencies of the federal government, private corporations desiring to support by contract research programs at the university would do so through the Purdue Research Foundation. The foundation would receive the monies and in turn reimburse the university for its expenses involved in the prosecution of these research programs. And for this service, the foundation receives a small percentage fee, management fee. This has been a singularly successful program. The Purdue Research Foundation has been used as the vehicle to enable the university to anticipate future demands for land. Obviously, one of the requirements of most universities is for more land. Purdue was no exception. One of the important programs was the purchase of all property contiguous to the university in West Lafayette. One, to protect the university and prevent the environment from prevent the university from being ringed with all kinds of undesirable t- tenants and property. When houses and land came on the market, Purdue Research Foundation would buy property near the university in West Lafayette. For instance, on Grant Street, those who knew the university in 1946, when I came to the university, will remember that across from the Memorial Union on Grant Street was a series of six or seven old houses.
Which would have been used as student dormitories.
Student dormitories, faculty residences, yes. A variety of purposes. All of them were old structures dating back to the early days of the history of Purdue University in West Lafayette. All those properties along Grant Street were purchased, and then when the parking garage needed to be built, we had the place and the land. And if you move right around the campus on two sides, the east and the north, we followed the same general scheme. And in University Park, a small area of residences completely surrounded by university property, bounded by University and Russell State and on the south and Stadium on the north. Control of that particular land and property is of vital importance to the long-range future of the university, because the university property completely surrounds it. The land now occupied by Graduate House East, Graduate House West, Krannert School, again was in this same category, land that parcels of which had been purchased as they came on the market, because we could foresee the time when that particular land, located as it was near the heart of the old campus of the university, would become exceedingly useful to the university, and it did happen that way. When I arrived at the university, the experimental farm was located in Bypass 52 in Lafayette, but it had been used as an experimental farm for many years, and the agronomists were complaining that the land had been used for experiments so long that it was no longer suitable for experimentation. Besides, it was in the growth pattern of the city of Lafayette. So we sold that land and purchased a large acreage north of West Lafayette. Now that university farm is being dismantled and moved further out, and that land is being developed as part of the city of West Lafayette, and the whole progression of development is paying for itself, no cost to the taxpayer. When the PRF buys land, which later then is given to the university, it's given to the university at the original cost minus any income the land produced in the interim. Thus, we estimate that millions and millions of dollars have been saved to the taxpayers by the Research Foundation being able to move in advance and buy long before something became needed.
Do you ever use the right of eminent domain on this?
No power of eminent domain given to the Research Foundation, only to the university itself. Power of eminent domain was only used, to my knowledge, once by the university in connection with the acquisition of the land where most of the big dormitories are now located, that to the west of the campus. When Dave Ross was chairman of the Board of Trustees, he knew and understood the value of land and the fact that the university would need land in the future. Period. The university, under the state laws, could not buy or sell land unless the legislature specifically authorized such purchase or sale, and for purchases provided appropriations. Hence, you had no freedom of movement with respect to the purchase of land when it became available. It would take a couple of years before you could get the legislature to appropriate for purchase. And by that time, somebody else had purchased it. One other point about the financial management of the university. In order to have good financial management, you have to have good financial control and good financial management. Careful management of every dollar and how it's spent and all the obligations of the university to all those people with whom they receive money. Sometimes these controls prove to be onerous to faculty who don't understand that strict and good and efficient and high-level business management is the greatest single protection for their jobs and their salaries and their security. Through the years, our salary scales and support for our people has been equal to the best in the state university scene, not only in the Big Ten, but also in the state university part of the total higher educational system. And in some of our particular programs, we have led the league, particularly in our retirement program. Which of course has been with Teachers Insurance and Annuity Association since 1937, I believe. For many years, our program was the best in the Big Ten. Coupled with this, of course, you have the medical insurance program of the university. And then, of course, the supplementary income to faculty members under Social Security.
May I interrupt here long enough to go on side B? This is the end of side A. Side B of an interview on August 29th, 1972. We're talking about retirement, sir, and...
Well, that's just one of the financial programs that I thought was should be mentioned, since from very early in my time, I made every effort to make it a superior program. One of the innovations that was brought into being by Vice President and Treasurer Freehafer a good many years ago now was the appointment of a business officer to work in each dean's office, to provide each dean with a business manager arm, keep track of his budget, his contracts, his financial obligations and expenditures, and to do all the analytical work vis-a-vis the dollars and people and programs so that the deans would have a complete financial picture of their operations under their jurisdictions. And the schools of the university, the professional schools of the university, all are different in their size, the constituency they serve, their special problems. The numbers game varies greatly from the smallest professional school to the largest professional school. The forms of external support, contract support, grant support, eleemosynary support vary for the various professional schools. And this scheme of financial service to the major divisions of the university enables the deans to meet their financial responsibilities with expert help. Most deans have come up to their administrative posts through the from the faculty, have little or no experience with the financial management problems of the schools of the university. And historically, the deans, department's heads have found that the management of their dollars has been a chore which they weren't equipped to manage and didn't particularly like as individuals, because their career and history had been professional and academic and research and teaching. And this particular development gives the Vice President and Treasurer an opportunity to take his young men on the business office staff and assign them to the various schools of the university and then move them around as they gain experience and stature and age and skill and so on. And in general, these financial officers assigned to the deans become keenly interested in the programs of the schools to which they are attached and become devoted to their bosses, their deans, and become a right or left-hand bower for them in the daily management process that every dean faces, the process of relationships with his people, the salary problems, the contractual problems. Every research contract is different. All have different requirements. Contractual requirements which must be met. Somebody has to keep track of all these things. Deans generally aren't equipped to do this. So this particular development has been one of the major management contributions, in my judgment, to financial management of Purdue University. Credit must go to Vice President Freehafer for this. Another interesting management tool that was developed was the Office of Schedules and Space. Traditionally, in many universities, the space of the university was thought to belong to a department or to a school or college, whereas the space, the teaching space of the university, belongs to the total institution. To maximize its use, you've got to know where the space is, who uses it, when they use it, and why they use it, and what for. And the Office of Schedules and Space gives us a management tool in the sense that the president's office knows the uses to which every square foot of space in the university is put.
Does the Office of Schedules and Space report directly to the President?
Office of Schedules and Space reports generally to the, it reports both to the Vice President, the Treasurer, and to the President. And all deans, the physical plant people, the Vice President and Treasurer, have to work with the Office of Schedules and Space with respect to, one, the scheduling of the use of the space, and two, the design and development and planning for all new structures to dovetail with what we have. We started the 10-year building program back in the early 50s, in cooperation with the other three state universities. That 10-year building program was completed in 12 years. Almost a record in dealing with legislatures. And after that, a second 10-year building program was worked out for the university. This required a comprehensive, detailed knowledge of what you had in being and how it was used, and what you needed to, what the priorities were and the timing was of all new structures that you added year by year by year. I remember interview I had with, when we decided to establish this particular office, interview I had with Jim Blakesley, a young engineering graduate at Purdue. I said to Jim, if he'd take this job, in 10 years' time he'd be the nation's expert. And this is exactly what happened. Because under Blakesley, working with the registrar of all the schools, we developed the computerization of our entire scheduling. And this was impossible unless you knew what you put into the computer in the first place. And in order to know what you put into the computer, you had to know every classroom, laboratory, on the campus and where it was located and what its size was and how many student stations and what it could be used for and all the rest of it. And we were the first and only university, one of the few major universities that succeeded in making that whole operation work. Making it work was one thing, but the most important outcome is that the scheduling of our students by the computer results in better schedules. Not only that, but the technique was developed to the point where you could drop an ad and handle the whole problem of the complexity of student scheduling. Other institutions, Indiana University in particular, tried to imitate us. And they got into such a terrible mess that they couldn't handle it and went back to the old method of gathering the faculty in the field house and having long lines of students registering for courses.
I remember that when that was done at Purdue, with the small number right after the war.
Yeah, as you remember it, we had to do it that way at the university before the development of the computerization of our entire operation.
Didn't Ohio State succeed in doing it too?
Well, I think other universities have succeeded in doing it. We were the first and pioneers. And we succeeded in solving all the difficult computer problems that were associated with this particular operation. It's worked extremely well. The problem of research contracting, particularly with the arms of the federal government over the years, is been a difficult financial management problem. Research grants for the support of a research program in a department like chemistry or psychology or physics, engineering, generally provide for support of the research program, the direct costs, plus an overhead. The amount of the overhead varied with federal agencies, but as far as the university was concerned, there was a perennial and continuous argument between the departments and schools of the university and the central administration. They not only wanted the money for the direct support of the program, but they also wanted the overhead, thinking then that that would give them extra monies. Whereas the overhead of the university was not the overhead of the department of the school, it was the total overhead of the university. And so we have been strict on this particular problem and have seconded all overhead portions of research contracts to the general budget of the university. The overhead involves, of course, the maintenance and heating and lighting and power and all the subsidiary services that go to make up the university, without which there would be no research contract in the final analysis if it, the total university didn't exist. When industry has a research contract with the federal government, it's generally a contract which provides for all expenses for the research contract plus 100% overhead. Universities got overhead according to the Blue Book formula, federal Blue Book formula, which incidentally was worked out in the main by Vice President and Treasurer R.B. Stewart for the federal government. To help satisfy the arguments that existed between the universities and the Defense Department in particular, which wrote the first original Blue Book, in order to bring sense, financial and accounting sense, out of the whole problem of overhead. Each university had its own specific overhead rate determined according to a formula. And when a Defense Department contract was written for provide a research program involving so many faculty people and so many students and so much space and equipment and supplies and so on, to that amount, the direct cost was added a percentage figure for Purdue University or for X University or Y University, depending on what their particular overhead figure was. Those overhead figures vary with the locale of a university. For instance, heat, light, and power vary between a university in the north and the university in the south, depending on the severity of the winter. And, of course, practice is different in universities, and the overhead rates varied as much as 10%.
Is the formula still being used?
Oh, yes, the Blue Book formula is still being used. This has been a subject of much congressional debate, too, during the year, as to what this overhead figure should be. With respect to outright research grants from National Science Foundation and so on, for those grants, generally, there is no overhead figure, just an outright grant. But it's not a research contract. You're not obligated to perform and report. It's just for the support of the faculty and the university's research program and the students involved, research fellowships. This story is a long and complicated one. The story of federal research grant overhead charges and the legislation governs this. Funny thing, the federal Congress always wanted to write a tougher overhead policy for the universities than they did for industry.
Would they assume that the universities wouldn't know how to manage the money as well?
No, that wasn't the reason. Industries wouldn't do the research unless they had 100% over the end. Or better.
Simple answer.
Industries would do it. They'd take any money, regardless of the terms. And I think the general background of the congressional attitude towards overhead was that they wanted to maximize the expenditure for the particular purpose for which the money was granted, namely the research program. They didn't want to provide $100 million for research and have $50 million of it go into overhead, 50% of it. So they were legislative writers limiting overhead to 20%, that kind of thing, for many agencies of the federal government. And some of the new research programs require university participation. When you make the proposal, you have to say that you're willing to spend so much university money in return for which they will then help you.
What, so, what is it, 80-20? 90-10?
Oh, it varies all over 90-10, that kind of thing. So you have to have money yourself to spend for a specific program from your own sources if you want to get additional money from the federal government. Well, I'm told that even in the Depression years, when the banks were closed and so on, Purdue continued to function without difficulty. Purdue has never operated a deficit budget. All budgets are made on a conservative projection of income available. Always balanced our budget. One year early in my tenure, you spent more than $2 million more than they had. This is this under the law is a crime. Those responsible could be indicted and sent to jail. In those days, the legislature appropriated the same amount of operating money to Purdue and Indiana. When we learned that they had spent $2 million more and had asked the legislature to make this up, we insisted that we have the same amount, because we had balanced our budget. The amount came to something over $1 million in the next biennium, you see. We only learned this after the fact. The legislature wouldn't give us the full million, but they gave us something like $750,000 more than IU for that biennium to make up the fact that they bailed IU out. But they also put increased reporting, financial reporting requirements in the university, quarterly reporting requirements. And of course, while we were not guilty, we were then faced with the imposition of more controls from the State House.
And as well as additional cost.
And some additional cost because of the other guys failure to operate within his budget.
Was that Herman Wells doing, or do you know who did it?
Well,
Herman was responsible.
Herman is president, and obviously had something to do with it. But it wasn't a very happy time for Mr. Wells. It was in the second Shricker administration. Well, I think that's enough of finance for today.
Want to talk about anything else, or shall we just go off the tape?
We'll go off the tape now.
All right, this is the end of an interview on August 29th, 1972. President Emeritus Frederick L. Hovde, and it's for the Purdue University Archives.